All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. How are you? Are you okay? Are you doing all right? Man, I've got to assume that everyone's tired of this shit. And by shit, I mean this fucking president. Anyway, today on the show, I talked to, I'm going to talk to J.K. Simmons, the actor. You know him. He was in Whiplash, Juno, Oz, Law and Order. He just did a movie called Palm Springs with Andy Samberg. He's on the Apple TV Plus series Defending Jacob right now. He's an upfront dude, man. Straight ahead, straightforward. No bullshitting. So that's happening. That's going to happen. You're going to hear that happen in your head. Got to confess, I did something crazy. I did something crazy. And I'm fucking going to have to get another test because I don't know if it was worth risking my life for, but I went and had my car washed. Can you fucking believe that? What is wrong with me, man? I went and had my car washed. I took it to the place. It's not as good as it used to be, but that was before COVID even. They sold it and no one goes there anymore, but whatever. Watched it go through the machine just like old days, just like old times. That weird, strange feeling of pride as if you're doing something, watching your car go through the machine, through the brushes, thinking like, look at that. Look what this is great. I'm doing something. I'm out in the world. Then it goes out and the guys dry it and then they open the door and they get in your car. Other human beings that I don't know getting in my car to wash it, to clean it, in my car. But everyone's wearing masks. And when they got done, I walked over, I tipped them, I kept all the doors open, then I opened all the windows, and then I brought with me a spray bottle filled with alcohol, and I sprayed the inside of the car a bit, misted it with alcohol, drove away quickly with my mask on, with alcohol fumes kind of filling the car, and then air coming in from the outside. I think I got away with it. I don't know. Uh-oh. Where's the thermometer? Where's the fucking thermometer? Quick. You guys, look, I'm grieving the loss of a loved one. And I know a lot of you people are up to your fucking necks with your loved ones. You've had it. You're at the end of your goddamn rope with your loved ones. Because how could you not be? I mean, when is this shit going to stop? How much can you take of your loved ones? Am I right? Cherish every moment. That I can tell you right now from somebody who is dealing with loss. And that's not an unusual thing to say, but it's hard, you know, the cherishing every moment, the living every moment, the being grateful for every moment, the sort of like make sure you know how amazing it is to be alive. Warren Zevon said, enjoy every sandwich. Fine. But 5 months of sandwiches, come on. It would take a fucking saint, am I right? I'm sorry. What I meant to say is, like, I know things are difficult for some of you in terms of, you know, the stress of proximity. But I also think that probably some of you are going pretty deep. You're going pretty deep. Probably deeper than you ever imagined possible with your significant others, with your children, with yourself. But again, 5 months is a long time, and maybe it's time to rappel out. It's time to climb back out. Gone deep enough, let's get back to some surface shit. God, I got to assume that people are just craving passing attention from strangers, even. Just the feeling of walking by some people at the mall, and you can see their faces. Remember? I imagine some of us are missing behavior that borders on inappropriate. You looking at me? Yeah. Mild flirtations. Office crushes. You can hang in there. We're okay. We're okay. All right? Talking to Lipsyte last night. We have our nightly phone call. Me and Lipsyte. Sam. Got a new book out. We're just riffing. Talking about public bathrooms. Because he went out into the world for the first time in months to his office And he owned up to using a public restroom. And I was like, dude, I fucking used a bathroom on the way home from Albuquerque at a rest area in the Mojave Desert, man. Just a bunch of trucks parked in the lot. People coming and going. Had to go. Yeah, and I had to do that one. Yep. Who knows? But I think I'm okay with the COVID. No one was in there. Door was open. Had my mask on. They had those little things that you put on the toilet seat. I don't know what that stops. But COVID is not the issue there. You're going to get some sort of like trucker butt. And we started trucker eczema. We just started riffing on what one could possibly get from a trucker's ass. And I came up with the winning answer, and that was rig chiggers. Got to watch out for those rig chiggers. That's you sit on the trucker toilet, you can get some rig chiggers. Winner. Bing, bing, bing. cried to Sam Rockwell. I did that. I went down into the bunker at DreamWorks to record some voiceover stuff for this movie that I'm doing. Animated movie, Bad Guys. It's me and Sam Rockwell and Awkwafina and I believe Craig Robinson now. But you rarely read with the people, but they like when me and Sammy read together. And I met Sammy a couple times and I've interviewed him. And he was in a Lynn Shelton movie and I hadn't seen or talked to him since then. And it wasn't that he was there. They fed him in on video. It's very clean there. No one was there. I was the only one. There's a sound engineer, the guy who walked me down into the bunker, and me. Very clean, very safe. And they brought Sammy in on the video, and then you got the producers on, you got the director on, you got the sound guy on, you got the like five or six people on. And I saw Sammy, and he said, you know, how you doing? And he's talking about Lynn, and I just lost it. I started crying. I said, it's hard, Sammy. It's hard. He said, I know, man. I can't imagine. Had some time with Sammy in front of all those people. And sadly, they're not going to be able to use it for the character. The sort of criminal snake character I'm playing, there's no use for tears, so we don't have a blowout moment. Nope. But stay strong. Be there for each other. It's important. I'm here by myself. It's not great. Don't love it. Dealing with it. Don't like it. It's scary somehow. Is it, though? Is that what it is? Loneliness? Is loneliness scary? No. It's not so much that it's scary. It's just sort of like, okay, I guess I'm just going to walk over here now and eat this. All right, look at me. I'm sitting on my couch. It's my couch. I like my couch. This is a good couch. I'm glad I got rid of that old couch. I guess I'll just watch this movie that's on in the middle. I guess I'll watch it. I feel like I just watched Munich. So Jewy. Oh, God. Okay. All right. So, listen, let's do this now. J.K. Simmons, the actor, is in this Apple TV Plus show, Defending Jacob. That's on now. Palm Springs, the film, is streaming on Hulu. And this is me talking to J.K. Simmons, coming up. J.K.
Mark.
Is that what you, is that what people call you? That's what they say to you? They go, hey, J.K.?
Yes, generally speaking, there are a variety of nicknames that people who've known me, you know, more than 40 years might use.
Yeah,
but we haven't known each other that long, so
we've known each other literally 30 seconds, I think,
roughly.
But no one calls you by your name.
No, I don't get a lot of Jonathan or except actually it's a good thing too, because when I get, you know, a random phone call and it says, or email or whatever, it says Jonathan, then I know it's going to be BS. Yeah.
Right. That guy doesn't know me.
Yeah.
Not reading that shit. when did you become JK? How does that happen? I've never gotten that. I've never gotten abbreviated, or I kind of wish I had a nickname. How does that happen?
It happened actually every time I joined an actor's union, they would take away part of my name because somebody else already had it. So by the time I finally got around to joining SAG for a job uh-huh. that I ended up not doing, and paying money that I could not afford on my regional theater actor salary to join SAG and have my name taken away. I just, JK actually kind of made sense. My father had occasionally called me JK or Jake when I was a kid.
Jake.
And yeah, that's one of the nicknames that some of the old pals call me, actually.
I like that. Jake's a good name.
I gave it away. Yeah.
So literally when he signed up for the union, they're like, no, we got a Jonathan Simmons. We got a John Simmons. We got a Jonathan K. Simmons.
J. Kimball Simmons.
Yeah. All taken. None of them popular actors. That's the thing is all your names are taken, but you don't know who the fuck those guys are.
Yeah. Well, but you know, maybe they're making a living somewhere.
That's true. That's, I mean, yeah.
Doing what I was doing for 20 years before anybody heard of me.
I know. It's like, it's sort of astounding that you, you hung in and seemingly didn't get miserable and bitter and resentful, but I don't know you that well. And, perhaps
I try to keep that only in private, only for those near and dear to me. So I only really annoy, the close people.
Yeah. That's how you test your family. That's what that's
absolutely.
For.
Yeah.
But I mean, where did you come from?
Born in Detroit I have to say Grosse Pointe, but then people see Mansion. So I was born in the slums of Grosse Pointe.
Yeah.
Detroit adjacent, and then spent several years in central Ohio growing up, and then a few years in Montana, went to college there.
So you don't remember Detroit? You would think like Detroit would have been something.
No, I do. Yeah. I mean, I was 10 years old when we left there, still a big Tigers fan and all that. So, but it's mostly a baseball team to me at this point. We don't really have any family or friends back there anymore. So,
yeah, I'm always curious to talk to people from Detroit in its heyday, because it sounded like, you know, the industrial period of Detroit must have been amazing, but then just the rock and roll period must have been amazing. But
I was 10. So it was, yeah. I mean, my rock
just
and roll
baseball.
Period was in the suburbs of Columbus when my dad was teaching at Ohio State.
Oh, yeah.
I did have a couple of bands.
You were in bands?
Yeah, sure. One was, a duo and a trio. I was very acoustic and very mediocre.
Uh-huh.
We wrote some original Crying, Dying, Going Away love songs and stuff and did a
what
lot.
What year
of,
was this? How old were you? Was this the 60s?
Yeah, 68, 69, 70. Yeah, you know, early mid teens.
Long hair. Do you have the long hair?
Oh, I had the hair. I had the beard as soon as I could grow it. You know, the scruffy beard coming in. Yeah.
Sure.
Went from jock to hippie freak at about
overnight.
That age.
What?
Just, yeah. just had to happen. Blew out my knees, which was a blessing in disguise. And you know, I was like, okay, football wasn't, you know, quite as fun as I was pretending it was anyway, so I'm just gonna turn on TuneIn, drop out, and play rock and roll.
So you started as like a jockey guy?
I started as a lousy guitarist, singer, songwriter, and then when I got out of high school, I ended up I thought I was super cool, and I got a gig at Ohio University as a disc jockey on a not even the campus radio station. It was each green had its own tiny little radio station that basically broadcast to three different dorms. So I was doing the graveyard shift, doing my progressive rock, you know, playing like entire album sides of Emerson,
yeah, for,
Lake, and Palmer's first album. And, you
for
know,
12 people who might have been awake.
Yeah, 12 was optimistic, yeah.
But that was great. Well, it's so funny because when I said jockey, I thought like I was talking about football. So you blew out your knees in high school, so that was behind you. And then we end up, you know, turns out, you know, you're a long-haired, but you're not even going to the college? You just got a gig being the DJ?
No. I was going to the college.
Okay.
I snaggled a way to get out of high school a year early, actually, and started at OU when I was just such a child, you know, now looking back.
Were you playing coffee houses?
My friend and I had played coffee houses. My friend Randy and I had played coffee houses in high school.
Right.
And we were at OU together, but didn't really continue that. At least we didn't get any gigs. I don't remember if we kind of still strummed around a little bit.
Do you remember when Kent State happened?
All too vividly. Yeah. I would have been a freshman in high school, I guess, 1970, in Columbus, you know, at Ohio State. And we had, and there were things going on there, with the same awful consequences, but, a lot of student protests and stuff going on there, and the cops shooting beanbags at people and quelling the crowd.
And your dad was he taught there?
My dad taught at Ohio State for several years before he went out and became the head honcho at the University of Montana. Yeah, not head honcho, not like president of the university. I mean, he was
right.
Head of the music department.
Well, I mean, let's not diminish that. That's very important.
No. It was a great gig for him. And Montana was a beautiful thing for our whole family of five, and then six ultimately, with my my mom's mom ended up joining us when our grandpa passed away, and we had a whole Waltons thing going on there for a while.
How many siblings you have?
Older sister, younger brother. So my little brother was in high school. My sister and I both transferred to University of Montana, and we all ended up graduating from there. And we lived under one roof again after my sister and I had both been away from home for another 2 or 3 years.
Well, so you got lucky with the, parental draw, and that it seems like that they were encouraging of the arts, and that there couldn't have been much resistance given that that was your dad's job.
Yeah. And they had met in college, actually, in a musical theater production, Kismet, as it turns out. Literally. They definitely encouraged us, and we all, at least dabbled in the arts and performing arts. And
did your mom stay in the arts?
No. Well, she stayed in the arts as an administrator for a while at Ohio State, and then with the Arts Council in Montana, and then more in the business sector after that. They were always big supporters and continued to, leave a real legacy in that way in Missoula, Montana.
Missoula. I just talked to somebody else from Missoula. Who the hell was that?
Dana Carvey.
Is he from there?
Yeah.
That's the one guy you know?
We haven't even met, but he grew up there. I didn't move there until I was in college.
I always picture Montana to be beautiful.
It is indeed. Don't tell anybody else, though, because they don't want more people there.
Do you have a place there still or anything?
No, we've thought off and on over the years about getting a place, but we just, we go there almost every summer and visit, and either Missoula or up on the lake, and started doing my summer theater there. So I have a lot of friends I've had for, 40 years or more now that we go back and have little mini reunions oftentimes in the summer up there. It is beautiful.
Yeah. I got to get up there before, I don't know, someday when we can all move freely, if that day ever comes.
Yeah.
I noticed on the credits, I was looking at some of your credits, that you've already done a voiceover for a COVID informational video.
Yeah, that was weird, because we did, it's a Netflix show called Explained, where they explain different, scientific things, rocket science,
Right.
And this was over a year and a half ago now, like more than a year before COVID hit the United States. The topic was pandemics in general.
Huh. Yeah.
And the thrust of the show that I narrated was kind of like, hey, we're not ready. We could be, maybe we should be, but not just the US, nowhere. I mean, the world is not ready
for a pandemic.
What the scientists kept saying was, an inevitability, a not if, but when kind of scenario. And then,
And it happened.
Shortly after it happened here, we did a little home recording update and made it a little more, coronavirus specific. So it was not a happy recording session, but hopefully a helpful one.
Where are you holed up?
We're holed up in L.A. now. We were all, our kids are in college in New York.
Yeah.
So my wife and I, stalking them as all good parents do at that age.
Right.
We had met in New York and done Broadway and,
sure.
Loved New York. So we got a place in New York a little over a year ago. And the four of us were there just at the time when New York became the epicenter. So we
got out.
I rode my bike on the last day before everything just shut down, every non-essential thing shut down. I I rode a bike to Queens and got a minivan, threw my bike in the back of it, went back to our apartment and, you know, threw a bunch of junk in there. Our son, we were pretty sure, had been exposed. Well, he had been exposed. Turns out he was not, he didn't have the virus, but we thought he did. So really? my wife went full on MacGyver and manufactured this like boy in a bubble kind of thing for him with a bunch of old, you know, plastic recycling and duct tape that we had.
Really?
Stuck him in the third row of the minivan and the four of us, you know, pedaled to the metal from New York to L.A. in about 2 days.
With the kid in a bubble?
With the boy in the bubble and the girl up as far away as she could be from the bubble in the passenger seat and me doing most of the driving and my wife partly documenting some of it and then when we stopped for gas once she commandeered the driver's seat and made me take a break. But yeah, I mean we just got out of course, now we're in the new epicenter in Southern California, so yay.
Well, I guess there's really no benefit other than it's easier to isolate here in Southern California.
Yeah, that's definitely having a backyard and...
I mean, New York, there's no way you can avoid anybody, ever.
Yeah.
There, you know, that was just built for, you know, spread. But how'd your son feel when he found out he didn't have it and spent, 42 hours on the road in a bubble.
And of course we couldn't, you know, testing was not available. So we didn't find out until maybe 2 months later. You know, he and I both finally got tested for the antibodies. And we were like, nothing. Wait, what? He didn't have it. His roommate had it. And you know,
did he get sick? Is he all right?
No, the roommate still cannot smell or taste anything, which a lot of people, especially back then, didn't know that was one of the symptoms.
Oh God, it's just so fucking terrifying every day to be alive right now.
It's just daunting. Yeah.
Daunting. That's a good word. Yeah.
But, the good news is Ben did not get really sick. The bad news is he can't smell or taste. But again, the good news is, you know, then why not eat nothing but broccoli and spinach if you can't taste it anyway? So he's been super healthy since then.
Get in shape. Yeah. It's time. Yeah. Yeah. There's no pleasure in eating. So,
might as well
get in shape.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, yeah.
Exactly. Now, when did you shift from a bad singer-songwriter into acting?
Hey, not just mediocre, not bad.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mediocre. I apologize.
I transitioned from, acoustic coffee house, James Taylor wannabe into classical Leonard Bernstein Pavarotti wannabe studied classical music in college, which is
singing though, like opera
my dad's or milieu. Yeah. Singing, composing, conducting.
Oh, wow.
You know,
really? How are you at the sight reading music? Good.
Used to be adequate. It's one of those muscles I haven't used in a long time. Although when Whiplash came around, whatever that was 5 years ago or so, Damien and I first met to talk about me doing that. And I had read the script and, you know, was, you know, not an idiot. So I was in love with it and wanted to do it. And the first thing he wanted to assure me was that I shouldn't worry too much about the technical aspects of being a conductor and a musician, and we could fake a lot of that. And we'd have a body double and a technical advisor and all that. And I was like, dude, I have a college degree in conducting and composing and singing. He was like, what? So that was, I mean, that was one of the coolest aspects of that gig, especially as we were doing it.
That's crazy. You were the guy.
I was actually reading those charts and, you know, we were, and all the guys, all the musicians, and I say guys, cause you know, it was 99% guys.
Right.
Those were all actor/musicians. They weren't, you know, the music we were making isn't as great as the final mix sounds, but during all those band scenes we were really cranking out the tunes, and I wasn't just waving my arms around. I actually kind of knew what I was doing.
Right. And it's why it's interesting, because it's probably not something, the effort it would take to fake well would have been extraordinary.
Yeah, that's always been one of my growing list of pet peeves that you see in films, is, you know, somebody, you know, playing a baseball player who, you know, clearly, you know, has never swung a bat until he, you know, picked it up to do that, or musicians. Right. I mean, conductors and musicians. I mean, it's such a hard thing to fake, you know.
It really
is. Because you're usually playing, obviously, a character who performs at a high level. So
I just did a film. I was in, I played Jerry Wexler in this upcoming Aretha Franklin film. And with Jennifer Hudson. So there's all the Muscle Shoals scenes. And they hired to play Spooner and Dave and all those guys. They hired real musicians. So like all the dudes could play.
That's a beautiful thing. That's the way to do it.
It really is. It's not like they had a few lines. There's a balance to it. It's like they're going to look like they're playing, but you don't want them to talk too much.
Yeah.
They're the musician actor crossover, rarely successful.
Yeah.
So you study music and you're studying singing, composing, and is this like and your dad must be thrilled.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it took me a while to wrap my brain around that's what I really wanted to do, because it just seemed so, I want to be like daddy, you know? So, which is why I didn't gravitate towards it immediately, you know, when I was 16, 17, 18, but ultimately. And my brother, my younger brother got a degree in music too. And he's a real Renaissance man, you know, singer, performer, writer, conductor, teacher, all around world saver. In Phoenix, Arizona, the UBUproject.org. Our sister, dabbled in a lot and ended up having a career as a college professor. She just retired from University of Washington.
How's your brother doing? That place is a COVID shit show right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, like everybody else, he's doing a lot of Zoom and a lot of this and that. And, you know, just hunkered down and trying to get through it. It's feeling more and more to me like hibernation here, and just waiting
people
for
getting,
spring, which will come, I guess, with the vaccine, I guess.
Hopefully. I mean, people are definitely getting a little squirrely, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
So, all right. So when do you start, where do you start training as an actor?
Well, I did a musical theater, community theater production of Oliver when I was a music student, playing the pivotal role of the knife grinder.
Uh-huh.
And had like an 8-bar solo, very exciting. And then the guy that directed that, an old pal, Jim Caron, was directing at this summer theater in Big Fork, Montana, looking for a music director. So I got the gig as the music director, and then they asked if I'd also audition for the shows, and I was unwisely cast as the lead in Brigadoon.
Yeah.
Because I could sing. And that was the beginning of me being a terrible but passionate and willing to learn young actor.
So not mediocre, but truly bad.
Oh, absolutely awful. And such a blessing that there's no video from those days.
But you could sing, right?
I could sing, and I had hair. And so I was, you know, I did a lot of sort of musical leading man things. I was there for four years, during college and after college, going back to the Big Fork Summer Playhouse, doing my thing and learning and having some great mentors, Jim Caron and Todd Peters, and, got to work with some really wonderful directors who were sort of age appropriate and taught me how to be less terrible.
So you mean as an actor?
As an actor and a human being, yeah.
And so, like, did you, so, like, because I when I watch a lot of your roles, and I've watched your work, you seem to be like a sort of like, you know, like almost like a practical actor. Like, it seems like you've got a set of tools that you apply, and you transform your emotional spectrum appropriately and your intensity appropriately. It seems like that. It seems like you lock in a certain way.
Well, and I've learned certainly from a lot of people since then too, you know, I mean, up to and including Damien Chazelle and, you know, all, some of the great directors that I've had an opportunity to work with, Jason Reitman and the Coen brothers and Sam Raimi. And
so you learned something from all the directors. They actually mold you somehow.
I think so. Certainly, certainly back in my theater days, you know, working with Jerry Zaks on Broadway. And I mean, one of the things I preach and try to practice is, you know, I mean, to be open to learning something new every day at work or every day, whatever, in life.
So when was the, what is the sort of trajectory? You were after Montana, where do you go to pursue acting?
Really, a lot of people from Montana did what I did and went to Seattle, which was kind of the nearest, you know, big city with especially at that time, you know, late 70s, a real burgeoning performing arts community there.
And yeah.
Stumbled into my union card, Actors Equity card at Seattle Rep. And I was in Seattle for almost 5 years before I finally got up the nerve to go try New York City.
So Seattle Rep, and that was like you were just doing, you know, a rotation of plays.
Well, it wasn't actually a repertory company by the time I got my card there. It was you know, one show at a time. So I got my equity card as an understudy in a production that I, you know, was never on stage in, and then worked at a few different. I worked at Seattle Rep, you know, a few other times in small roles, and at ACT there was a dinner theater there at the time, an equity dinner theater. So free food 8 times
sure.
a week. That was, you know,
yeah.
Yeah, it was a great beginning and really equipped me well for you know, another, even after I moved to New York, I was basically doing regional theater for another 7 or 8 years before I got my first Broadway show.
And when, like, regional theater, generally those are, you know, what characterizes it? Is it just accessible productions for older people in other that
Boy,
you bring
really,
it to them?
You're really selling it, man. Yeah.
Well, I hear
no,
it a lot.
It's not just the blue hairs. It's, I mean, look, every you know, decent sized city in the country has you know, professional theater going on with you know, usually a combination of local actors and sometimes, you know, imported talent from New York, L.A., whatever. I mean, I worked you know, I went back to Seattle and did a show there. I worked in whatever, Atlanta, Boston, Buffalo. Yeah,
but what
Albany.
Would they hire you? How did that work, though? You would just get cast.
Yeah,
they
would. They would have casting sessions in New York and L.A.
Right, right.
And I got to know enough different casting directors in New York. Got to know me that saw me in different ways. You know, one guy would see me as the musical leading guy. One guy saw me as a, you know, Shakespeare guy. Another person saw me as a, you know, so I actually was able to have a, you know, pretty well-rounded career as a theater actor and not get pigeonholed too much. And yeah, I mean, you'd go back to New York, you'd wait tables or tend bar or whatever, and, you know, play softball in Central Park during the day and wait, you know, for another audition and get a gig, go to Buffalo for, you know, 4 weeks of rehearsal and a 4 week run and then go back and do it all over again.
Yeah. I didn't mean to come off as condescending. I guess what I'm confusing certain things with, like, regional theater is really, it's real theater. Every city's got its theater, and it's usually, 9 times out of 10, it's a well-operated, you know, sound structure, you know, that some of them have been around forever. And they're just doing real shows. Like, I think I'm confusing it with, like, in my mind, it was dinner theater where you're doing some sort of shtick with.
Yeah. Well, and which I certainly did. There was, you know, some dinner theater, as I already have confessed to. Mixed in there, where I did. I played the third knight from the left in Camelot.
Uh-huh.
And,
yeah.
And also did a play, an old chestnut called Bell Book and Candle. But most of it was regional theaters, you know, doing really good work. And believe me, there's, you know, well, not right now. I mean, right now, good Lord, stage actors are among, you know, the most devastated group in this, because there ain't no work for them. And you
That's
can't
right.
even go pick up a gig, you know, tending bar or waiting tables. So,
right.
But, you know, in a non-COVID world, you know, there's thousands of actors that most people haven't seen, you know, making a living out there doing good work in regional theater.
And would you like? Would you have you considered yourself one of those actors for a good chunk of your life? Or
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for 5 years in Seattle, and then another 13 years or so, and then I was a Broadway guy for 5 years. Really,
what were some of the big shows?
The first one, not a big one. It was a little musical called A Change in the Air, H-E-I-R.
Uh-huh.
Subtitled A Musical Tale of Good and Medieval.
Huh.
And that was the funniest part of the show.
The title.
Yes.
Okay.
It did not do well. In fact, the contract in those days, the production contract, the Broadway contract, you had a 4-week out. You could give 4 weeks notice,
right.
At least on the contract that we had.
Yeah.
And I ended up giving my 4 weeks notice 2 weeks before we opened, because the writing was on the wall. That was terrible. Among other notable things about it, though, was it was the first time my wife saw me, because the show was so terrible that they were papering the house, they call it, giving away free tickets to all the other Broadway shows to come on their night off. So my wife was doing Cats at the time, an actual Broadway show. And she was among the people who subjected themselves to an evening at A Change in the Air, and she saw this magnetic, incredibly good-looking, charismatic, sexy guy up there. And lo and behold, a couple of years later, then I did a big revival of Guys and Dolls with Jerry Zaks and Nathan Lane and Faith Prince and Peter Gallagher.
Oh, that was a big show. That was fun, right?
Oh, it was huge. Still, some of the most fun I've ever had in the business or in life was rehearsals, really, and previews for that show, and sitting around with that group of hilarious people listening to Jerry give notes. And that was really, really, really fun. Yeah. And then I did A Few Good Men. I did the Peter Pan revival, which is where I finally met my wife and Michelle Schumacher, by the way. I was Captain Hook and she was Tiger Lily.
Oh, there you go.
So we had a kind of an illicit romance going on there.
Uh-huh.
And then a Neil Simon play, Laughter on the 23rd Floor, with a really fun cast. Yeah.
That was about a writer's room, right?
It was loosely based on the old Sid Caesar
show
writer's
shows.
Room.
Yeah.
And that was Nathan Lane. Nathan and I did sort of two shows in a space of 3 years, because we did Guys and Dolls and then Laughter together. It's a great cast. John Slattery and Lou Stadlin.
Oh, that guy's good. Yeah. Nathan's a great guy. I really like him.
Really, really great guy. And so, so like, so unusual. I mean, almost unique that there's a guy who's like got a really, really great career as mostly a theater actor. I mean, obviously Nathan's done a lot of really great, TV and film stuff too, but to be, an actual theater star,
That's really his thing.
That's an unusual thing now. Yeah.
So now during all this Broadway time, you're going to auditions, right? For TV.
Well, yeah, no, not really. I mean,
no?
I was really happy to be where I was, and I'd never really even thought about a career in television or film. I did once Guys and Dolls hit, and we were like the hit of the century. It was crazy.
How long did that run? Like a year?
No, I ran like 4+ years. I mean, most of us end up leaving, for greener pastures after a while. And no matter how big a hit you're in, when you're doing your 414th performance, it's a little like punching the clock at the factory,
Is that how many you did?
Let's see. From the first rehearsal to when I left the show to move on was a year and a half. I probably did over 400 performances.
Oh my God. So how are you not like hearing that in your sleep?
Oh dude. Yeah, I mean, it gets into your head sometimes. And even with Laughter, which we did for like just under a year, 11 months. But still that's, almost 400, cause you're doing 8 a week. So, and then I did on tour again, with my wife, Michelle Schumacher.
Well, that must have made it better.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, we're banking double per diem. Are you kidding me? We're shacked up. I mean, it was.
Yeah.
No, it was great. But it wasn't really until Laughter on the 23rd Floor, which was my last Broadway show in 94.
Yeah.
So I'm already pushing 40. And most of the people in that show, Nathan, John Slattery, Mark Lynn Baker, most of those actors had, you know, theater and screen.
They'd done a lot of television, huh? Yeah.
Yeah. And they were getting, you know, mailbox money, as we call it, you know, a residual check once in a while. And I was like, wow, that sounds pretty cool. So when that show put up the closing notice, I told my agent I didn't want to audition for any more plays. I wanted to see if we could get some film and TV going. And a couple of lucky breaks came along with an episode of Homicide, Life on the Street, Tom Fontana show that then led to Oz and Law and Order and all that.
Well, I mean, what about it seems like if you live in New York and you've got any chops at all, you're going to end up on one of those procedurals at least a few times.
Oh, you read every playbill you go, you know, you see, you know, television includes Law and Order. Yeah.
What about the films? What was the first film?
The very first film was The Ref.
Dennis Leary's movie?
Dennis Leary film. And I had
that John Demme? Did he direct that?
No, it was Ted Demme.
Ted, yeah.
His nephew.
I remember that because, you know, that was a big break when, you know, I'm a comic. So when he got that, we were all like, oh, man, Leary doing it all. Yeah.
No, it was his first big movie star
thing. Yeah.
And he was great in it. And it was a really terrifying and great experience because I was this, you know, I mean, I'm this whatever, 40-ish, you know, average bald white guy. I don't look like it's my first rodeo, but I was, you know, I was like I was shot out of a cannon. Of course, Ted, I mean, the director is, you know, I don't know how much younger than I was at the time, but, you know, grew up in the business and, you know, even at that time felt like a seasoned pro. Some of my scenes were with a 14-year-old actor who had done, you know, 14 films. It was a little bass backwards in many ways.
Yeah,
but really fun experience. And Leary was great. He was a really great guy.
So the TV, though, it's interesting because I think my first memory of you, the one I can't get out of my head, I don't know if it's the first memory, but when you were tattooing a swastika on that guy's ass in a jail cell.
Wasn't that sweet?
Yeah. I mean, I'm never going to be able to shake that.
And you know, my mother was so appalled because, and this didn't make the final cut because of a rights issue I get, but I was, as I was tattooing poor Beecher's buttocks on that show, I was humming a little lullaby that my mother had sung to me when I was a little boy.
Called, come on.
Hush, little baby, don't you cry. Hush, little baby.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Because, you know, I didn't want him to.
Oh, my God. That show was so heavy, man.
So twisted. And
what was the name of that actor?
Lee Turkesson.
Good actor, that guy.
Lee Beecher, really good actor. Yeah, and he's still working a lot and keeping busy. And a lot of guys from that show I've stayed in touch with over the years.
That was a long run. That was an intense show, and that was an intense character. I mean, that must have been an education in and of itself to stay in that groove for that long.
Yeah, it was a huge, first of all, you know, put a lot of us on the map really for the first time. And second of all, an education in many ways. And really we got spoiled in a lot of ways too, because the way that show was run, you know, largely because of budget limitations, you know, the days there was no over, I mean, well, there was overtime, but we didn't go over 12 hours. It was like 7 a.m. The bell rings at 7 p.m. Everybody goes home. Guys were still doing Broadway shows and Oz. At the same time, no long waits in between shots. It was like bang, 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 set it up. Because we were shooting a, 56, 7, 8-minute show in a 7-day shoot. I mean, so we're shooting, 9-10 pages a day a lot of the time. And it was.
God, that's a lot.
You'd get a take in and they'd go, okay, did anything fall on anybody's head? I mean, let's move on, you know? It's like, so then when you get onto a big film where they're actually, you know, taking 2.5 hours to set up the lighting and doing 9 takes of something, you're like, oh my God.
It's tedious, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So where did they shoot? Did they shoot that at Silver Cup? Where'd they shoot Oz? Like, where was
I don't know if Silver Cup even existed then. Well, it probably did. No, we shot the first, we did six seasons. The first four we shot at the Flower Well Warehouse in Chelsea.
Oh, on
9th Avenue.
And, so they just built sets in there, and that was not even...
They just rented the whole top floor of that warehouse, which was not anything like what it is today. I mean, it was just a few florists on the ground floor and a bunch of, you know, mostly unused offices. And of course, you know, had a handshake deal with the landlord. Hey, if the show's a hit, you know, don't worry, I won't screw you, you know.
Right.
So 4 years later, he tries to screw Fontana. And so yeah. The last 2 years, we're going to quadruple the rent. What do you say, you know?
Yeah.
The last 2 years, we shot on a pier in lovely Bayonne, New Jersey.
Bayonne.
So we went from, like, I was riding my bike to work. My wife and I got married like the year before Oz started.
Yeah.
I'm riding my bicycle to work. We're having an hour walk away at lunch, and you can actually walk away and go to one of the, you know, hundreds of restaurants in the neighborhood and, you know, run off and do a voiceover audition, you know, in between shots. And then, you know, the last 2 years were marooned at an old military barracks in Bayonne.
It's so odd that, like, he chose to do it that way over a soundstage, I guess, for budgetary reasons.
Yeah. I mean, it was cheap rent. It was, and honestly, now that I think of it, it was probably just because Fontana could walk to work from there. Cause, he still lives in the neighborhood. So,
and then what do you think was the, so that puts you on the map. So what do you think was the big kind of film break for you, where, because I remember, I think it was probably Juno for me in terms of remembering, you know, like, who's that guy?
Well, that was huge. I mean, God bless Jason Reitman. I was in his first movie, which is a underseen and I think maybe underappreciated movie called Thank You for Smoking.
That's a good movie with who's that blonde guy? What was the lead guy?
Aaron Eckhart.
Yeah,
that put Jason on the map, and justifiably so. Obviously, he grew up in the business. He'd made a bunch of short films, and you know, that was another one of those experiences where I was kind of like, you know, still felt like a kid, like a beginner as a film actor. And this guy who's, you know, I mean, I basically could be his father, you know, is like a mentor to me.
He's got a good pace on those movies. There's like, he's got, he definitely got a good feel for it.
Absolutely. And makes, I mean, you sort of, you know, can tell a Jason Reitman film, but he also doesn't repeat himself though in sort of the obvious ways, you know? So, you know, each one is really its own unique self. And before Juno came along, he had no intention of directing any script that he hadn't written himself. But then he read Diablo's brilliant script for Juno and actually handed it to me at a poker game, handed me the script back in the days when people handed people scripts.
Yeah.
And I had sort of welcomed him into an established poker game at that time, because I asked him if he played poker and he said, not really. And I said, perfect.
you're in. Bring a lot of money.
Yeah. Of course, like after, you know, the first four times he played with us, he became one of the best players at the table because he's just a super smart, annoying guy.
Yeah.
But he handed me the script and said, you got to read this. It's great. And didn't say, you know, I'd like you to play the dad, you know?
Yeah.
So I read the script and I'm falling in love with the part of Mac McGuff, you know? But then thinking, well, let's be realistic, you know, he's going to get, you know, some big movie star to play that part. So maybe this one scene part or that one scene part. And then I called him the next day or a couple of days later. And, you know, I was just trying to sort of chat. So, hey, man, how's it going? that's a pretty good script. And he was like, dude, we want you to play Mac McGuff. I was like, oh, yeah. He and Dan Dubecki were putting that together at the time. And really, they went out on a real limb casting both Ellen Page and me, because Jason knew when he read the script that he wanted me, he wanted Ellen, he wanted Allison Janney, he wanted Michael Cera. I mean, he knew most of the cast in his head already, and he also knew that it would be a hard sell because the producers wanted, you know, the young pop star, you know, at the time, who was
oh really
becoming a film actor, and they wanted you know, they wanted somebody established, you know, to play my part. And
right.
So Ellen and I, and Ellen was just coming off that movie. Was it Hard Candy? This horrible, I mean, great film where she had played this victim of this kidnapping who'd been starved. And she was, I mean, she's already a tiny little, you know, 97 pound thing, but she had starved herself. And I mean, she looked like hell.
Yeah.
Probably 87 pounds. And she and I did a full on old school screen test together. And, you know, Jason went and, you know, sold us to the powers that be, the money people. And, you know, we got to make the movie. Yeah. And that was obviously huge in my career because I had done, you know, some kind of high profile stuff like the Spider-Man movies where I was this over the top, you know, screaming guy, and
yeah,
and people knew me as the bad guy from Oz and stuff. So it was a great opportunity, and especially when Juno became what it became. Yeah, to see, yeah, the kinder, gentler side of whoever that bald white guy is.
Yeah, I thought it was, and also there was something unique about the language of that movie. There was a patter to it. That
brilliant colloquialism that Diablo created that was and that Ellen, you know, and the rest of the especially the young actors, you know, really ran with so brilliantly.
Yeah, it was great. Everybody was great. It did sort of I was happy to see you in that role. Yeah, I was traumatized by Oz on some level. I watched it every week, and it was a relief to me that you weren't a monster. But it took you about a decade for you to erase whatever Oz did to me in terms of how I looked at you.
Well, you know, and then, that was one of the things that, you know, when they first asked me to do Oz, and I realized what a huge opportunity it was, but I also realized, you know, if this takes off, it's going to be hard for me to, you know, get away from.
Right.
And hard for me to do anything other than the Nazi bastard of the week on every, you know, procedural. And I actually expressed that to Fontana in a meeting. And after he got done looking at me like, are you kidding me? You know, like this guy that's making, you know, $400 a week, you know, is thinking of turning down this career changing opportunity. He said, look, I understand that. I appreciate that. That's, you know, really smart and forward thinking of you. And he said, I'll tell you what, sign the contract, sign the 6-year deal. He said, shake my hand. And if you ever want out, I will kill your character off the next day.
Really?
Just between you and me. So it's a win-win. I want you to do it and I want you to feel comfortable doing it. And then the other blessing was, you know, months after we finished the first 8 episodes of Oz, it was only 8 episodes per season. They asked me to play the shrink on Law and Order. So I'm playing the psycho here and the psychiatrist there. And right away, audiences that had never seen me before, or at least some audiences, are seeing, you know, two very different characters that I'm doing. So that helped me not get pigeonholed the rest of my life.
Yeah. And then it became, but right. And you become a character actor, not just a lunatic.
Yeah, exactly. Which is far preferable.
Yeah. yeah. But what was the first Coen brother movie you did?
I had auditioned for them a couple times, didn't get hired.
Yeah.
Although one time there was a film that they had offered me a part in, but because of Oz, the part was to play this, you know, Southern racist Nazi, you know, and I was like, I cannot do that. Please, maybe this part, that part, the other part,
yeah,
you know, even
part.
Smaller parts, because I was dying to work with them, but they have such a specific vision, you know, so that one didn't work out. And then I auditioned for the Lady Killers.
Uh-huh.
And they put me through the ringer. They put me through the ringer every time, those guys, because they always have such a specific vision in their minds of everything. I mean, when they're writing the script,
uh-huh,
they're already in their minds. They're in the editing room doing the final cut.
Right.
I mean, they're so thorough and brilliant. So I was very different physically from what they saw the character as in the Lady Killers, but they kept coming back around to me, you know? And finally the last time I auditioned, it was the two of them, you know, sitting on a couch in a hotel suite somewhere, I guess LA probably. And I read, you know, two or three of the main scenes for my character, Garth Pancake.
Yeah.
And and you know, I did the last scene, and they sat there and, you know, looked at me for a beat. They looked at each other for a beat, and then Joel, he goes, "Well, damn it, JK, that's exactly right." Okay, all right.
Yeah,
I guess. And I was like, "Oh, gee, well, thanks." That's you know, I mean, that was one of the best times I ever had, because Tom Hanks was such an awesome, you know, sort of movie star slash team leader, you know, to be doing that with, and the four of us who were playing the gang of, you know, misfit knuckleheads all had a great time together. And as usual, as I found out, as usual, I did a little part in Burn After Reading.
I remember that. That was a funny part.
A really funny part that, like, considering that I did the whole thing in one day,
yeah,
really paid off brilliantly. The scenes with David Rashi and myself were just like, just teed up everything in the entire movie for us to get to pay him off.
Yeah, there's a couple great beats in there, you know, when you have to troubleshoot the situation. That's very funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you make a big differentiation when you know that something's written to be funny? You just got to play it straight, right? Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, certainly the vast majority of the time, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if the intention isn't there, if it isn't, you know, grounded is the sort of actory word, you know, then it's just, you know.
What do you mean?
Silly and, teach me and that not one. Believable.
Right. Teach me the grounded one. It has to, the intention has to be grounded in reality or in the character.
Yeah. 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 Right. Well, both, you know, right. I mean, you still have to have an objective. You still have to have something that you're after and some place that you're coming from and some place that you hope you're going. And,
right.
If that's not a part of the, not even necessarily the style, but the substance of what you're doing, then it's just, you know, you can laugh at stuff, but if you're going to be with these characters, you know, especially for, you know, an hour and a half or 2 hours in a feature film, if you don't believe them and care about them,
yeah, why would you?
It's going to get pretty old after a
it's
while.
It's so funny because so many comedies, like big comedies, just throw that whole conceit of character in the garbage in the third act. And I find it annoying.
Yeah, that
you know what I mean? It's weird.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're going with it. You're like, all right, I'm going to suspend my disbelief enough to enjoy this thing. And then like, what's happening now? This is stupid. Yeah. Yeah, I don't.
How are they now on the moon?
That's not supposed to matter at that point. But working with the Coens, though, the primary takeaway is they know exactly, you know, what they want.
They're so low key and obviously just, you know, genius and brilliant. And that, you know, that line of dark comedy that they straddle so brilliantly. And I mean, they can make a film like, No Country for Old Men,
yeah,
you know, and then something zany like The Lady Killers or Burn After Reading,
right.
and do what are really vastly different films, but, if you think about it, have a very similar sensibility and just like being low key, cool guys to be on the set with. I think sometimes actors have a difficult time with them at first because they don't do that thing after a take where they come up and go, great. That was great. That was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. You know, they just come up and they kind of stand there and they go, okay, let's do the next, you know, and if you're one of those actors whose ego like really needs that feedback, you're in the wrong place.
You're working with the wrong guys.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of actors that do that. I mean, a lot of directors, I guess, you know, like you said earlier, that you learned a lot from a lot of these directors. I mean, most of the time directors, when they hire an actor, they're like, they know exactly what they want that actor to do. They're hiring you because of what you do. You know, they're not there to teach you how to do it. They want you to show up ready to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And whether you're a, you know, like when I was beginning and they're looking at you on tape, you know, and going, yeah, that's it. Or whether it's, you know, you're an established guy. Yeah, right. I mean, they're certainly not, you know, they're not in the business of, they're not, you know, college professors. They're not, in the business of teaching. But
well, yeah, but there's this idea, I guess, I had a naive idea that, you know, it's some sort of collaborative process where they're helping you make choices. Or I mean, I guess some of them guide you if you're not hitting it right. But most of the time, it's like, do the thing. And like, yeah, do it different.
Yeah, but where the brilliance lies in a guy like a Jason Reitman or Sam Raimi, the Coen brothers, is those little adjustments where, you know, you're obviously, you know, you're in the ballpark or you wouldn't be there to begin with, you know, but they're not getting exactly what they want. And the communication, the way they're able to communicate and get out of. And that was one of the things I noticed about Jason in the first film we did together was his ability to deal with a vast range of actors, you know, some really established, some young and nervous and, you know, this and that, and, you know, some more open to direction than others and, you know, and really able to effectively communicate and get his point across with anybody. And that to me, probably because I'm not all that visual a guy, I don't appreciate, you know, the brilliant cinematography and the creative vision,
right,
as much as some movie people do. To me, that's that communication, that ability to communicate with a wide variety of actors is the main attribute that I really respect and admire and appreciate in a
sure.
director.
Right, right. So that they can, you know, you're all, it is a collaborative work to honor the vision of the director and the writer and, you know, or how they interpret the work. So, you know, if they can sort of in a nuanced way and in an encouraging way, make that thing come together. I mean, that's the whole trick, you know, where they're not an asshole, you know, because you hear a lot.
And not being that is a big part of it, too.
Yeah.
Which is another common thread between the directors that I first of all have really enjoyed working with. And second of all, have worked with multiple times.
And you've worked with some assholes.
No, never. Not in show business.
Nah. I wasn't going to ask names. I was just going to ask if. Of course.
Yes.
Right? Yes.
And, you know, I mean, you know.
Yes.
Directors, actors. I mean, you know, craft services guy. I mean, you know, they're everywhere. But
yeah, you throw the craft services guy under the bus.
By and large, I've been fortunate and, you know, mostly been surrounded by people that you don't mind being surrounded by when you're working for 12, 13, 14 hours a day.
Yeah. And I have to assume that, well, obviously, but like to get a fucking, I don't know why I'm saying fuck so much with you, but it happens to get an Oscar, you know, for Whiplash at that age, after that life you've led, that must've been like just the best thing in the fucking world.
Yeah, it was all right.
Come on.
No, it was, I mean, honestly, I'd had this sort of stick in my rear for my whole life
uh-huh.
about the whole concept of awards,
sure.
You know, and for, you know, for creative artistic things. So
yeah, I get it.
And, you know, and nobody, I mean, you know, with a few small exceptions, you know, nobody had ever really been wanting to shower me with them anyway. So
I'm in the same boat, buddy, and I got the same attitude about them. How would
right?
They don't, they're bullshit, right? They're bullshit.
Yeah, what do they know? Yeah. What do they know? So I mean, honestly, I was, you know, when that whole thing was just taking off and we were the, you know, the belle of the ball at Sundance uh-huh. and all that, which I didn't even go to, but I was talking to, you know, the powers that be, the Sony Classics guys, Tom and Michael, about, you know, this is what's going to happen and there's going to be all this and it's going to get a lot of attention and there's probably going to be nominations and yada, yada, yada.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, yeah, no.
Yeah.
No, not interested. Thanks. I'll be at home with my wife and kids or working on whatever's next, you know?
Yeah.
And I really kind of had to get talked into it. And again, it was Jason Reitman who kind of talked me into, like, look, you either need to do this, you know, or you can be that guy and you can be like, no, I'm an artiste and I'm not going to do all that.
Yeah.
Or he said, or you can do it. And obviously everybody's telling you to do it. And there are reasons you should do it for your career, for the good of the movie,
yeah.
for Damien, for Miles, for, you know, but he said, here's the reason that you really should do this. He goes, everybody that you've known your whole life from your best friend in second grade before you moved away from Detroit, to all of your, you know, fourth cousins. He goes, all of those people are going to be so excited and so happy and so thrilled for you. The people you were doing theater with in Buffalo in 1979, you know, all these people, you're and obviously your close friends and your family, you know, the real reasons to do it, you know, that really sunk into me. And my wife and I had a long heart to heart about, you know, because it's a whole thing, you know, the whole like awards season is, it's like a, you know, it's like a real gauntlet that you have to sort of commit to.
Uh-huh.
And once we decided that it was something we could do as a team, and Michael and Tom at Sony Classics, you know, said, yeah, sure, we'll bring your wife and your kids along if you want them to come to whatever,
yeah,
you know, this festival or that, you know, awards thingy. And then obviously, you know, I mean, ultimately it just became a snowball rolling downhill, and the movie was so brilliant. And, you know, Damien had written me the part of a lifetime, and, you know, all the statues kept, you know, getting handed off to
me. You won every award.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy. So really, by the time the Oscars came along, it was, I mean, I had friends who were like, dude, do you know you're like 1,000 to 1 in Vegas? I mean, it's ridiculous. There's no way they're not going to give you this trophy. So when they finally announced my name, it was almost more a sense of relief than like, how big a schmuck would I have been if they'd have said somebody else's name?
Oh, right. Yeah, right, right.
And then, by the way, this is one of my favorite little aspects of that whole thing, because, I mean, you know, I sort of expected it, but obviously, you know, there's a billion people watching across the planet, and, you know, you're in the Kodak Theater with every famous actor you grew up watching, you know. So I was a little nervous, and as I walked up, and I also didn't ever, like, totally write an acceptance speech.
Uh-huh.
Like, I kind of always had a theme in mind. You know, for the SAG Awards, I want to talk about actors and about supporting and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I knew that if I was fortunate enough to, you know, have somebody hand me an Oscar, that I wanted to talk about what's most important in life, which is family, right? So I'm kind of, you know, formulating my thoughts and walking up on stage. And Lupita Nyong'o is the, you know, going to hand me the trophy.
Yeah.
And I reach out with one hand to take the trophy, and I reach out with the other hand to shake her hand like we're, you know, two dudes making a business deal. And then I realized, oh no, it's Hollywood. You're supposed to do the fake, you know, kiss on the cheek thing. So I kind of awkwardly go in for the fake kiss on the cheek thing. And I'm sure you can find this on YouTube. Gave her a little headbutt.
Did you?
kind of headbutted Lupita there. Just not enough to take her down. Yeah. But And then went on with my speech about, you know, about my wife and my kids,
yeah,
and call your mom and, you know, all that stuff.
In the moment that you did the headbutt, did you know you'd done it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
I was just glad that there wasn't a house laugh because it was subtle enough that most people didn't notice.
But it grounded you in the moment, huh?
Yeah, it did bring me back to earth. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it looks like they actually made up new awards to give you an award for that role.
Yeah, it was crazy, and it was you know, obviously a beautiful experience in every way.
That's great.
And, you know, certainly hasn't hurt the number of scripts that are coming my way since then. And have I always made the best decisions? No, but
how do
but,
you decide you know, I, now?
Well, I'm telling you, I still feel like I'm learning. I mean, I'm a senior citizen officially this year, but I still feel like I'm learning how to make those decisions. And I 90% of it still for me is just, you know, what's on paper, and is the script there? Is it great writing?
Mm.
Is it a character that I you know, understand where he's coming from, and somebody that I want to play? Is it funny?
Right.
If it's a comedy, is it moving? If it's, you know, something dramatic, and that's, you know, that's 90% of do I want to be involved in this project, and then the rest of it becomes logistics. It's like,
yeah, what's the time? Where's it shooting?
Is it shooting in Kathmandu? I'm not interested because I got kids in school and I don't like to be away a lot, you know. And then who's in it? Who's, you know, isn't it, you know, director, this, that, the other thing. But one of the things that I don't take into account still is, you know, do I see that it's, you know, going to be a big success,
yeah,
or, you know, get a bunch of awards or you know, does it have that kind of pedigree to it? I still just try to gravitate towards stuff that I, you know, fall in love with because it's good. Yeah.
And your wife is also in show business, yes?
Yeah, Michelle Schumacher. I've done a couple of films that she's directed as well. Well, some short films too. But we started out as, you know, theater actors, yeah, together. I was basically robbing the cradle. I was in my mid-30s when we met, and she was in her mid-20s. On that Peter Pan tour with Kathy Rigby.
Yeah.
And so we're doing our theater actor thing. And then once we got married and the baby started coming along was just about the time I was getting the film and television thing kind of rolling and off the ground. And so she, you know, you can't be doing a play on Broadway and, you know, have your character go through, you know, 9 months of pregnancy. So,
not without a rewrite.
So she became a brilliant and dedicated, full-time mom for a long time. And then, you know, once the kids were, old enough to, you know, be in preschool and this and that, she and some friends started putting some little short films together. And, her last film, was a beautiful little indie film called I'm Not Here that features three actors playing the same character. I play him as obviously an old fart. It's available on Amazon Prime. I'm Not Here.
I'm going to go. Keckner's in it. I know Keckner. Yeah, I'll check that out.
Keckner is a kind of a, I guess you got to call it a cameo for Keckner.
Yeah.
And believe me, going in.
Mandy Moore. Love Mandy Moore.
If you're going to Mandy Moore, Max Greenfield. I mean, it's great, great cast, Sebastian. You know, really, really wonderful cast. Because again, it was a script that my wife, Michelle, and her writing partner, Tony Cummings, put together that, you know, once it got out there, there were tons of actors who wanted to get involved in this for, even though it was, you know, paying like super low budget scale, nothing. You know, the good thing about those movies, whether it's that or Juno or Whiplash or, you know, whatever, is, you know, everybody's there for the right reasons. You know, they're there because they love the story that you're going to collaborate and
tell.
They're,
yeah, for sure.
There for a money or a big career break or this or that, or to set, you know, yeah. Anyway, it's a beautiful movie. But if you're a Keckner fan and you think it's going to be,
I just know him.
You know, Anchorman 3. It's not the usual Keckner.
My reaction when I saw his name was like, I'm glad he's working. You know, I'm not. It wasn't like.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, that's always my. No, and I love Keckner too. I mean, we go back a ways too. So that's always my reaction when you see any of those guys, you know, that you've work with over the years, and you see their name on something.
Yeah.
Oh, good. His nine kids, in Keckner's case, his 19 kids are gonna have another meal.
Exactly. Well, buddy, that was it's great talking to you, man.
Hey, you too. This is really fun.
It worked out really well, and you know, congratulations on everything. And it's you know, you're a good dude, and it's good to see you so busy.
Thanks, son. You too.
I'll talk to you soon, man.
All right.
All right, so that was good. He's exactly like you thought he would be, right? You can watch the limited series Defending Jacob on Apple TV Plus and the film Palm Springs on Hulu. Go back and watch Oz. Go watch Juno. Whiplash. Now I will play some fairly simple, but nonetheless heartfelt, dirty blues music. Enjoy. We'll be right back.
Boomer Monkey Lavanda.